For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
There we go. Let's make sure this shows up on the YouTube. I don't see it, though. This is the thing. It says we're going live.
We are live.
It says we're live. I don't see it, though.
What?
I don't see it either.
Wait,
look in the comments. I don't know if we're really live. Yeah, look at the comments. That will tell you if we're actually live or not.
Are we live, you guys? Let us know in the comments. Just spam us. You are live.
I don't know. That's the thing. I don't want to do my intro and then
we're not even live.
We're not even live because we could be live. It says we're live.
Wait, some people are like, I see you guys, not live. How are people saying not live?
do you see it?
It's not popping up on my YouTube yet. So
is it popping
I got two
up
different phones.
All right, let's check.
Imagine how weird this is going to be for the replay if we are actually live right now. And then
we just fall apart without Kevin.
Yeah, seriously. We don't. What do we do?
Where's the governor when you need him?
Yeah.
Imagine if we did the entire episode, by the way, and then it was just never posted.
Video's unlisted. Yeah, maybe make it public. See if that works.
Let's see. Hold on. I'm so afraid. Public? I'm so afraid. Should I just do it?
Do it.
Just do it, man. Just do it. You only live once.
All right. Let's oh, man.
Hey, right. The problem is missing. Yeah. Kevin's
the
not
problem
here.
Is.
There we go. We did it.
Yes. Yes.
I see it. Hey, guys.
Oh, yeah, okay. We're live.
So welcome to the next episode of Millennial Money. This is going to be a really interesting episode because we're missing Kevin, and we've spent the last 20 minutes trying to figure out how to work this. Kevin was able to get us up on stream, so we're good now. The few difficulties we have is that we don't know the chat. We might have to leave the chat just open. This one. Let's see. Usually we'll go to member chats after 10 minutes. But anyway, we got a very interesting episode today. We're going to be talking about the issues with the new variant illness that's going around. We got a lot of stock market earnings going on this week. We got Bitcoin, which went almost to 40,000 before coming back down a little bit. We got real estate prices that continue to get more expensive. And Andre just got a haircut.
I did it, and they cut it too short, and I'm like, come on, they're leaving me there like that. Come on. I'm going to Maui, though, so I'm super excited. Maui is tomorrow, and I've never been, and I'm so excited. I'm going to get a fake tan later on because I was going to whiten my teeth, but I decided to get a tan instead.
Nice. Did you do you pre-plan your videos ahead of time, or are you just going to take a day off?
I planned one ahead of time. It's kind of an evergreen, and I'll still have to film something there, so hopefully something exciting happens. thank you fresh. Said I'm fresh. All right. All right. Yeah. So yeah, I've got one planned, but hopefully something exciting happens.
Nice. And who cut your hair?
Clearly myself. No, somebody from Great Clips. And this is not sponsored by Great Clips.
I went to Supercuts.
I'm bad at giving instructions. I'm like, just make it short and shorter on the sides, off the ears. And they're like, all right. And then I'm like, I'm never happy with it. So,
yeah. I went to Supercuts the last time. I think it was like $15 right down the street. They did a good job. It was a little too short in the beginning, but I thought it was fine.
They do tend to cut your hair a little bit short, but there's another more high-end one. It was like a barber. I forget the name, but they're great. Anyway. Delta variant. Let's talk about it. What is going on? So did you guys see that the Delta variant is apparently between like 40 to 90% more contagious than the original strand? Well, that's scaring off a lot of people. I know you said, Jeremy, something happening in Vegas here. We're not, I don't know, things are looking a little scarier.
Jeremy, we can't hear you.
I'm just kidding. I'm just messing with you.
Don't do that to me.
Oh, the technical difficulties. No. So anyways, yeah, the Roni Rona, man, it's back and it's more vicious than ever before. And I don't know, man. I'm almost more worried about this one a little bit because it's so dang contagious. And then everybody's, I feel like, checked out of Roni Rona. Like, we're so over it, right? And just when life was getting back to normal and you're starting to see concerts and sporting events and all these things again, it's like right back up in our face. And it's just frustrating, man, to even have to deal with this anymore. But this one's super contagious. The numbers are getting bad. I'm tracking the numbers in Vegas. I'm tracking the numbers around the United States. And I heard, you know, a month ago, I had people telling me, you know, in some of these places internationally, the Delta's just been going nuts. And so it's unfortunate, man. And, you know, I don't see a way out of it, to be completely honest. I think we're going to have to be back in masks. I think there's a high probability. I don't know if we're going to have to shut down the whole economy and all those sorts of things, but I'm really, really worried about, like, you know, even like I'm thinking about football season, like, you know, NFL, college football, that was supposed to be back to normal. Stadiums packed again. And I'm looking at these numbers and we're still in summertime. It's July. The craziest thing is the numbers are going to really explode likely in the fall time. And so it's a little worrisome, and obviously the stock market's a little worried about it. You know, what's your perspective on this, Graham?
Yeah, it seems like we're going to be going back to the masks, which I think just, you know, whatever we need to do, honestly, I'm all for it. And that's what I think is probably going to happen. I can't see them putting on further restrictions, but I can see them saying, hey, guys, you know, we were asking just for vaccinated people without the masks. But now we want everyone to wear a mask just in case. I've also heard quite a few stories anecdotally from a lot of people who have had the vaccine and are now getting the new variant. So I'm thinking maybe there is more of a risk than people let on, which is certainly a possibility. So I could see us going back to masks. And at least from the good side of this is that it does appear that the symptoms for vaccinated people are not as severe as they were a year ago. So at least there is that.
Yeah, there are apparently people in Congress that are getting COVID even though they were vaccinated. So it's kind of interesting. Would you guys go to get another vaccine if the government just told us to, hey, you need another update? Would you guys go back and do it?
Yeah.
I mean, the boosters, I think, are gonna need to, like, you're gonna have to get the boosters, I think, because the regular shot, what is it good for, 6 months or something like that? Or after 6 months, it really starts to wear off. So I heard something like that.
No way.
No?
Like the original? No, the original vaccine should last for life. But I mean, if there's another variant, they're going to give us a booster, which should also hopefully be for life too.
Okay.
Yeah, keep on coming every 6 months and get a new injection.
Well, that's the thing with like the flu shot. You got to get a new one every season if you're somebody that gets a flu shot, right? And so, yeah, man, it's, you know, I don't know how all that's going to work out, but it's frustrating. It does make me worry a little bit about travel stocks because I am thinking, man, if all of a sudden we're back to masks. But at the same time, you know, Vegas, we were building some business even last summer, you know, when it, you know, everybody had this, you know, the biggest Rona fears. There were still the masks and whatnot. And then it makes me think, like, let's say, you know, business is limited in any sort of fashion, are we going to have stimulus? Like, where would you guys put the percentage odds on any sort of stimulus checks being sent out in this year or the beginning of 2022? Where would you put the percentages on that?
Ooh, so far, I'd say about 30% for me right now, 30%. If it gets worse, because I'm seeing on the CDC website right now, it says 56,000 7-day moving average. So 56,000 new cases, which is pretty substantial and it's growing. So far, I'm going to put it at 30%, but 40%, 50% sounds reasonable too to me. Yeah.
Yeah. What do you think, Graham? What would you say percentages are of another stimulus round coming back half of this year, beginning in 2022?
I think pretty slim. Realistically, okay. I think the chance of that happening is, I don't know, 20%, maybe 1 in 5. I think what's more realistic is that I think probably the child tax, what was it, $300 a month, the child credit, I think could be continued. I know a lot of people are pushing for that. So that's what I could see. But I don't know. I think things would have to get pretty severe for another stimulus round to come out.
Although I will say that if we do get another round of stimulus, I hope by then, which I don't think it will happen, but I really wish it did, if the government could have its own stablecoin ready, because can you imagine how fast they would pay people out if they actually had a stablecoin in place that they can just directly send to people? That would be so much faster than waiting through the traditional banking system. So, I mean, that's one big benefit of a government, like Fedcoin, if you want to call it that. That would be awesome, but I don't think they'll have it ready by then.
That's true. Yeah. You know, what's interesting. I wonder how much of, you know, Bitcoin's rise, a lot of stocks rise, you know, could be attributed it to, you know, the stimulus checks when those were sent out. Cause you know, obviously there was a huge kind of move upward in Bitcoin, all crypto prices, as long as there's stimulus. And then right shortly after that last round of stimulus, that's when it seemed like crypto started to fade. A lot of the growth stocks, more speculative retail trader names, start to fade. And so it does make you think, man, like how much of that stimulus money got put into crypto or more speculative stocks. As soon as people got it, they're like, if you didn't need it, all of a sudden it's like, okay, let me just invest it.
Huge. So. Yeah, that was the boom of shorting, right? Not shorting. Gosh, the hedge plays. Everyone was doing options trading. That was the rise of options trading. That was that era. So I could totally see that if we do get another round of stimulus, that would be huge for speculative assets, especially.
Yeah, even indirectly. Imagine getting a $1,200 check and then spending it at the local store. Of that, let's say $200 is profit for the store. And then the store is doing pretty well. And you say, well, with this extra money, let me go and put it in GameStop. So I think at least even indirectly, within a few months, a lot of that would flow back through the economy.
I will say, though, I hope the government doesn't limit business operation. I think that is the worst thing we can do. Like, I don't care. Force us to wear masks, force us to get vaccines. Like, I don't care. Just please don't shut businesses down, because that's what leads to less profits. That's what leads to, you know, downsizing. That's what leads to unemployment. And that's just when things get way, way worse. So like, regardless of how bad things might get this time around, I just hope that we don't shut businesses down. That's my biggest fear.
Yeah. Yeah. I think if there, you know, is any limits of business, like let's say, you know, the Rona is going crazy in the fall again, right? And let's say the numbers are even higher. I don't know. I could definitely see potentially cities, states saying your restaurant can only be half full now or 25% full or taking, you know, doing some of those things again. So I think if that happens, the chances we get a stimulus again is I think higher. But and then Graham, you know, maybe you can speak to this. I hear a lot of, as far as real estate goes, about forbearance and some of these things kind of going away, and then unemployment maybe be taken away. And a lot of people, I've been seeing messages about September, October, these sorts of things. Can you speak to any of that? And do you think it's going to have any impact on real estate or not really?
Yeah, that's the eviction memorandum that's going to be ending. So that's what it is. So the theory is that there are potentially millions of tenants out there who are behind on their rent, who would be evicted normally, but because of this memorandum, they're not being evicted. So they think that once this expires, all of a sudden, all of these landlords, millions of tenants, are all going to be displaced, put on the street. That's going to cause a housing crash of sorts. So when you really get into it, though, you begin to realize that, that very few tenants are actually really behind on the rent more than like 60 to 90 days. And when you look at the National Multifamily Rent Council, I forget what it is, I'm blanking right now, but when you look at their website, they have a database that covers like 20,000 different rentals across the entire country in various income brackets. And what they found was that we have about 2% more than usual in terms of tenants paying their tenants paying rent late more than 60 days. So we really don't have as much as people say. Like, people keep saying, oh, you know, a third of tenants haven't paid their rent in time, in full. But by the end of the month, pretty much 94% of tenants get caught up by then. So I think what's going to end up happening is that, yes, there's a subset of tenants who are behind on the rent. I don't think it's as bad as the media portrays. And I think of those tenants who are not paying, as soon as they know they could get evicted, they're probably out of there pretty quickly. And landlords are probably out there too, wanting to do cash for keep. Eviction is really the last case resort for any landlord. You would hate to go through an eviction, and especially when things would get so backed up. Like, imagine processing hypothetically 500,000 evictions. That's going to take months to go through. So I think once it ends, that landlords and tenants will be able to work it out, or tenants will just straight up leave.
And when does that expire? September, was it?
September.
September, right.
Yeah. So far, it's always expired. And then 30 days before, they've said, okay, now it'll expire October 31st. And then October comes on. Okay, now it's November. So they've continually just kept pushing this off a little bit further.
Yeah. So I think what will be different this time around, though, is, like I think Jeremy was saying, Congress, right? Congress is different. Now we have a Democratic trifecta. We have the House, we have the Senate, we have the President. So stimulus will come fast and hard. That's what she said. And debt is the other difference, right? So because these small businesses have already taken on those loans, they might not be able to take out those loans again to survive. So I think that second wave, if we get it, will be way more devastating, just because I don't see, you know, the cruise lines, the airlines taking on billions of more debt and surviving after that. I don't know. Jeremy, what do you think?
Yeah, no, you make some really good points there. I actually have a question, because I've never rented a property to anybody, and I've been fortunate to never be like late on payments. But what are the rules as far as eviction goes? Like, let's say somebody's like 5 days late, can you just kick them out? Is it 30 days? Is like, what's the rule in order to like kick somebody out of an apartment or a home you're renting? How's that work?
It's not easy. It's a very lengthy process. So usually there's a grace period of, let's say, 3 days. So by the third of the month, technically you're late. Now, what a lot of management companies do is that on the third day, basically the minute it's late, you post a 3-day notice to pay or quit. That's what's standard. So like the second you're late, you have another 3 days to then pay. If you don't pay by that date, at that point, you could then go and file for eviction. That process could usually take anywhere from a few weeks, the very, very, very soonest, depending on the county, to a few months if you're in a place like Los Angeles or maybe New York. But even back and forth, I mean, there's definitely a time where the tenant knows what's going on. They can respond. They can try to pay their rent. They could try to work things out with the landlord. There's so many stops along the way to make sure that, like, eviction is the last resort. Like, you don't want to go through eviction. They really try to make it so that, like, the tenant knows what's going on. They could pay. The landlord knows how long this could take. So it's a few month process.
Have you ever had a tenant just not pay, or maybe pay on that third day but constantly delay their payments? Or if like they were a month late, but then they constantly kept on doing that and pushing it, because the whole process, like you said, takes months in some cases.
Yeah.
Like,
so here's the thing. Once you file for the eviction, let's say the paperwork is all filed, you got it in, and then tenant says, oh, you know what, I'll pay this month. I'll pay it. Once they pay it and you accept the money, then you have to start the process over again if they're late again.
So, yeah, that's what I'm saying. They could just continue to reset the process.
Yeah, but then you're getting paid as a landlord. So usually it's not a good sign if the tenant starts perpetually paying later and later and later and later until eventually it's just like, well, just stop paying. So it's usually something you gotta, you just gotta be firm on the dates. I mean, it's just like whatever's in the contract, you have to stick with it.
You have six rentals, right? You said six or seven?
Yeah, six or yes,
six or seven houses.
Because when I moved out of the duplex, it was like then I rented out that unit too. So,
wow.
Yeah.
And you haven't noticed anything go like off with your tenants? They haven't stopped paying or anything?
I had one experience where a tenant. This is the tenant that I've had since 2011. One experience in the middle of like the worst of the illness, she lost her job. Her mother unfortunately passed away, and until that point, and that was, I don't know, for what, 8 years, she's always paid on time, like exactly on the second of every single month, no matter what, she's paid her rent on time. So I knew this was like an anomaly, and she called me like ahead of time to let me know like, hey, I could pay the next month rent, but I don't have a job right now. My mom just passed away. I'm taking some time off. I can't pay you the next month. I'm going to let you know 100%. And for a tenant that has always paid on time for like 8 years, I'm not going to be like, well, no, you got to pay. So I told her, listen, don't worry about it. At this point, like we've known each other for such a long time. I was like, don't worry about it. The next month came around and she was really worried. She's like, what's going to happen? I'm like, and this is the worst of COVID, by the way. So like things were under lockdown. I was like, listen, don't worry about it. I think like 2 to 3 months went by and the entire time she's like, listen, I'm looking for a job. I got a job lined up in like September, but in between now and then I just don't have any money. I could try to make out. I was still, don't worry about it. She ended up getting a job and, then started paying again, I think 3 or 4 months later. And I just let it go. I mean, for a tenant who's been with me for 8 years, so oh, wow.
She didn't have to make up the 3 or 4 months of missing payments. That's awesome.
No. Because I knew that was like an anomaly situation. I knew that was not her like trying to swindle something. And what really made the difference for me was that, like, she was giving me updates on like her status of getting a job. Like she was actually like, this is what I'm doing. And I this interview went really well. And I was appreciative. I'm like, oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Good luck. She got it. She's like, okay, it's starting on this date. So I could resume payments then. And she even asked, she's like, do you want to work on a payment plan that I could pay this back? And I'm like, don't worry about it. Just, you know, stay there. Just continue at this point on forward. And that was it. And so far, she's been great.
That's really cool.
But for me too, it's like, listen, not only do I not want to kick anybody out, but she's been such a good tenant. I don't want to lose a great tenant like that, especially right. Over a few months worth of rent. It's just in a big picture, it's better for her to stay and it's better for me to let her keep a few months worth of rent if that means she's happy there for another few years.
That's awesome. Yeah. This is my first time owning a home and I've been a renter for, I want to say 8 or 9 years now. If I had known that I was going to stay in Vegas, I would have definitely bought a place earlier. But then I don't know if I would have had the courage to leave my job in the first place and, you know, for fear of losing my house for not being able to afford it. So renting in a lot of ways really saved me a ton of money and gave me a lot of freedom, which was awesome. But at the same time, I didn't build any equity. So it's a give and take. But yeah, I actually want to ask you guys about Robinhood. Are you guys investing in the IPO?
No, not planning on it. What do you know?
After Coinbase, that was my stupid moment of like buying in on IPO. I felt so smart for those first few minutes. I got in and saw it go to like 400 something. Like, wow, I just made like 4% in like a few minutes. The crazy thing is like
$380 is a great entrance point. I watched the video. I did my due diligence.
Yeah. So after that, I'm like, you know what? No, I'm gonna let the dust settle on that one.
Right.
In regards to Coinbase, if you look at when they went public, I'm pretty sure that was right around the crypto peak, wasn't it? Wasn't that right around when Bitcoin hit 65,000? There was like max like crypto enthusiasm in the market, right?
Totally. I think it was coming down. I don't think it was at the peak. I think it was on the downtrend. But around there, yeah, definitely around there.
You could say they went public at almost the perfect time in terms of how much money
they did. They did. Robinhood, on the other hand, I mean, did you guys see that new allegation that the CEO Vlad Tenev, he doesn't have his FINRA license, which apparently is not a big deal because a lot of CEOs don't have that. But they're trying to give him crap about it. And I was thinking the other day, you know, with Robinhood, it's I read one of the reports and the median account value is apparently $240 per person that is in, you know, in the app, which is very low in relation to some of the other brokers. So it's kind of interesting that if you compare Robinhood and how it makes money, which is payment for order flow, which is where they get paid from the brokers, you know, and they have this kind of weird relationship where it's a conflict of interest. If you compare that against some of the other traditional brokers like, you know, Charles Schwab or something, or Fidelity, where they can make money off, you know, the interest on their balances, which they have so many customers, they have such high balances and such high accounts that, you know, Robinhood is forced to sort of rely on this payment for order flow. But I didn't know this. I don't know if you guys knew this. The UK and Canada do not allow brokerages to make money with payment through order flow. It's illegal. It's illegal. Yeah. So here in the US, it's fine. And it's interesting to compare the different dynamics, because Robinhood argues that, hey, payment for order flow gives customers a better price for stocks. And that's exactly the opposite argument from, you know, the Canadians and people in the UK. They're like, no, it doesn't. That's a conflict of interest. That doesn't
matter. It's not surprising to me in terms of the average user having $240. A lot. How many people do you know that just signed up for Robinhood because they wanted the free stock? And then they're like, wow, I could get other free stocks if I get my friends to sign up. So they all get their friends to sign up. And pretty soon they have, you know, $20, $30 in their account very easily. Maybe they go and throw $100 in it. That's not surprising to me. The payment for order flow too. I mean, it doesn't matter to me how much money is in each individual account. You could have $1,000, just trade it back and forth every few days, thousand in, thousand out, thousand in, thousand out, and make Robinhood quite a lot of money. But I don't know. I mean, as far as payment for order flow, like objectively, we're not talking about a ton of money here for payment for order flow. It's like a hundredth of a cent, or it's like a thousandth of a cent
on the customer side. Yeah.
Right. It's so small that, like, even if you were trading millions of dollars, I mean, this would add up to like $10. Like, and if you're trading like a lot of money. So I think in the big picture, to offer free trading at a thousandth of a cent, I mean, the conflict of interest, but right.
See, my problem with the low account, my problem with it, the fact that the median is $240, is it kind of tells you that, like you said, it's just a random person just downloading Robinhood and just yellowing some money into it, which means that if regulations were to ever go against that payment for order flow, which, by the way, there is, they're just wondering like, hey, maybe we should stop this stuff. Maybe we shouldn't allow it. And if that happens, Robinhood would be really, really affected by that. And because some of the other big boy brokerages offer other more, you know, advanced products, you know, loans and whatever it is they do, Robinhood, because of its simplicity, I don't think would ever be able to integrate those more sophisticated product offerings. So in a way, their growth is sort of limited by the amount of customers they can capture rather than the products that they offer. And so unless they change that in the future, which I don't see them changing, just because they would have to change their whole interface. I mean, as soon as you get into loans, as soon as you get into these other things, it just gets way more complicated. So Robinhood, in a way, is kind of stuck with that simple trade model. But if regulation goes against them, there goes their entire business model. So that's the only like drawback that I see. And in a way, it's almost like going to the casino and just investing in this IPO. I don't know. I'm not going to do it because I learned my lesson with Coinbase too, but that's my take.
Yeah, and with the Robinhood, I mean, the $240 thing, I mean, I think that really shows you two things. One is that number's like so unbelievably low, like it's hard to even fathom. Like you look at Fidelity, I believe Fidelity's average account size is something like, I think like over $100,000. So, I mean, you know, it's such a different ballpark. Second thing it really shows is no one really takes Robinhood serious if you got big money. Because clearly, just like if somebody is building up on Robinhood and gets to any substantial amount of money, five figures, six figures, especially seven figures, it seems like they just move to another platform. They're like, I'm going to go with Fidelity or TD Ameritrade or Interactive Brokers or somebody like that. Because, you know, there's just, you know, if you think about it, like, if you have enough super wealthy people using it, it would help outweigh some of the smaller accounts where people just have a few $100 in it, right? But clearly those people, I don't even think are using the platform. And to be honest, I don't know if I know anybody that has more than 100K on Robinhood. You know, maybe usually, Andre, you really do. You have over 100K in Robinhood.
What? You don't watch my videos. How could you, Jeremy?
No way. Seriously, Andre? Whoa.
You know how much crap I get from my comment section? Anytime I do like a dividend update video, they're like, oh, this guy's an idiot. He uses Robinhood. I'm just like, leave me alone. It's funny, though, trading.
Despite all of that, they're still the largest. So it's either we're dealing with a small subset of people who are savvy about this. Wow, Andre, way to go. Wait, so is that all dividend stocks?
Mostly. I'd say 70%, but the other 30 is index. I'm shifting more towards index just because of tax implications, not because I don't love dividends. I still love dividends. I'm still reinvesting everything. I didn't sell anything. And I still want to build up a huge dividend portfolio. I know, Graham, you don't like dividends. I love dividends just because as far as like a retirement plan, I can actually see how much I'm making and then compare that against my expenses. But when you're going to be retired, you're going to have to sell off your index funds, which, I mean, by that point, you'll have so much money. It doesn't matter.
You borrow against the index funds, so you don't have to pay tax on it.
You borrow against the index fund?
Yeah. And then you avoid tax.
Right. Yeah. Then you could do that. That's a more sophisticated way of going about it. But anyway, I'm just saying you can better plan when you know what your income is versus your expenses. But I don't know. That's just my way of looking at it.
That's an interesting concept, Graham. Just spend 1 to 2 minutes. Just dive into that concept, because a lot of people probably just heard what you said there and they're like, what? Borrow against?
So what you could do is called a pledged asset line. So let's just say that you've saved up $1 million in the stock market. It's sitting there in an index fund. What you could do is you could go to your broker and they say, we'll lend you up to, let's call it 70% of what that's worth. And here's the term and here's the interest rate. So let's say for me, they say, okay, you have $1 million. We'll lend you $700,000 on a, I don't know what the rate would be right now, probably 2-something%. So we'll lend you 700,000. You'll pay us 2.2% a year. And then you'll just pay us back with interest. Now I could use my own income to pay back that loan. I could use the income that they basically loaned me to start paying it back. So every month that whittles down a little bit further. Or as the stocks go up in value, it should be going up long-term more than the 2.2%. So I could sell some of those stocks, pay back the loan, and then end up more than what I started out with.
Now, could you technically get margin called? Does the loan depend on the equity position, the value?
Yes. Yeah. So
you're basically living on margin is what you're doing.
Yeah. Well, yes, but with the pledged asset line, it's on an index. It depends. I mean, if you're in GameStop when they give you a pledged asset line, they look at the volatility of what you're investing in and the chance of it dropping. So let's say with something like GameStop, let's say you have $1 million in GameStop. They might say, okay, we're going to lend you 15% of that. And that way we have enough of a buffer here to make sure that we don't need to do anything. On an index fund, I've seen it at like 70 to 80%. And on bonds, I've seen it like at 90%. So it really depends on what they're loaning against. But yeah, so, I mean, obviously, if the stock market crashes and it's like, you know, a 90% drop, yes, there should be some repayment terms in there that says, you know, you have X amount of days or this long to basically make up for that.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Like, what if you're a retiree in 2007 and you're like, well, I've saved $1 million, but I don't want to sell it. I'm just going to live off this loan. So they do that. And then 2008 happens. They lose 50%. What happens to the loan? Get margin
but you're not pulling out 700,000 at a time. Let's say you have $1 million, you're going to pull out how much you might need for the next year. So you might only pull out like 10% of your portfolio. If that, realistically, you're probably pulling out like 5%.
Sure. Yeah. But I'm just talking about the rest of the balance. Does that get taken away or is that only?
No, because you're only loaning such a small amount for the overall portfolio.
Got it. So you're constantly taking out tiny loans rather than one big one.
Right, as needed if you need it. But yeah, but that's the concept that it works in some situations because you won't have to pay the upfront tax. Or you could do that long enough until you're maybe in a lower tax bracket and then you could start selling. But ideally, you don't want to sell. But it depends on what you're working on.
All our future multimillionaires out there, make sure you smash that like button for that game that Graham just gave you out there, man. Like, that's some good game right there.
Well, here's the thing too. If you have an income of less than, I forget what it, $40,000-$50,000 a year, you're not paying capital gains tax anyway. So if you're planning to live off of $30,000-$40,000 a year in retirement, you could just straight up sell off these stocks, pay nothing in capital gains tax.
And that's why dividends are awesome. Cases,
better. What?
And that's why dividends are awesome, because you could plan on a 50K a year lifestyle and be tax free.
Not necessarily. If you're making more money, though, let's say you keep working.
Oh, for sure. I'm just saying, if 100% of your income is purely from your dividends, from qualified dividends, you could be tax free 100%.
Correct, but you would have to structure that so carefully to make sure that you fell within that 0% category.
Oh. I feel like that strategy you spoke of there, Graham, I feel like that's really better if you got substantial amounts of money. I feel like it's more impactful, like if you got 3 mil, 5 mil, 10 mil in stocks when you go to retire or whatever. So
yes. Oh, yeah. I mean, you should not be doing this with, I don't know, it's probably, this is the strategy for like 5 million and above.
Yeah. So, which means everybody watching this is going to have
99% of people just left the chat.
I don't think so. Listen, I think a lot of people can work towards that. So,
for sure,
I don't think it's anything to scoff about. Well, especially a lot of people are watching this under the age of 30, especially anyone under 25. I mean, gosh, the sky's the limit.
Yes.
Sure. Speaking of becoming millionaires, Jeremy, what's going on with tech?
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Oh, well, that was a smooth transition there. On speaking about becoming millionaires, did you see tech get trashed today? No. Oh, gosh. So earnings craziness after the bell. You had Apple, you had Microsoft, you had Google, McDougal, all reporting earnings. And then you had Visa. Visa is a sneaky company, and I want to cover all these. But Visa, I was looking. I don't track Visa that heavily. Can you guys guess what Visa's market capitalization is?
I should know this.
I'm going to guess Visa. It's got to be over 100. I'm going to guess 100 billion.
Andre, you got a guess?
I have no idea.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So Visa's market cap is $550 billion now.
Wow.
That's bigger than 550 billion Visa is now, which is that's far bigger than like any company when I started investing in the stock market. Like the biggest of the big companies when I first started investing were like 300 billion market cap, 400 billion. So that's just crazy. But the big techs have all gone over a trillion, so it kind of dwarfs some of these other companies. I'm like, Visa's just a sneaky one that's just $550 billion market cap. Like, are you kidding me? But that business model is amazing, right? So anyways, they came out with earnings. They beat. Their stock went down. Apple, I don't know if Apple's up or down now after hours. They were down for quite a bit after hours, and they reported a perfect earnings. Like Apple's, it doesn't get better. They beat analyst expectations by $8 billion. $8 billion. They beat what analysts had expected. Like, it's crazy to think how few companies even can do $8 billion in revenue in a 3-month span. And Apple just beat the estimates by $8 billion. Like, just and then you had Microsoft reported great earnings. They had a double beat. Their stock went down. And Google reported such ridiculous numbers that their stock actually went up after hours. So they were the one that bucked the trend. Starbucks, Graham, was down after hours because they just beat by a little bit. So,
wow.
But
so, but how much does tech make up of the S&P? Was it not tech, but like the top four companies in the index funds? Facebook, Amazon, Apple, and Google. It's like 20% or something ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's like, yeah, yeah. The top five make up, I think it's either 20% or 25%. So, you know, wherever those stocks are going, they're really dictating a lot of where the market goes. And then if those stocks are bleeding, it carries the rest of the market down with it.
So tell me for a second, why, if all of these companies reported like smashing earnings, why did the market go down then? Is this the case of, you know, buy the rumor, sell the news type of thing?
Well, a lot of these stocks have been climbing, right? Apple, if you look at Apple, it's near an all-time high. And if you look at, you know, its market cap, it's pretty much near an all-time high, $2.5 trillion going into these earnings, right? And if you look at its trailing 12-month PE and you look at its forward PE, both of them are extremely high on a historical standard. Like usually Apple's going to trade between like a 10 and maybe a 20 on the high end PE. Lately, it's been trading at like a 33. So
wait. What did you say? Apple is historically between 10 and 20? There's no way.
Between 10 and 20 PE, and recently it's been like at a 30 plus. And so yeah. It's just trading really, really rich on a valuation basis. And so, you know, to get Wall Street and big money to go out there and want to buy Apple stock, I mean, even if they report some ridiculous numbers, they're still like, I don't know if I really need to buy Apple today. Buy it in the future, maybe when there's some bad news into the stock, maybe the stock's down. And so that's the thing that frustrates a lot of retail investors, because they think like, well, if they report amazing numbers, the stock's going to go up. Look at Tesla. Tesla yesterday, for instance, Tesla reported the best earnings of their lives, man. It was amazing. $1 billion in net income. Yeah, revenue went crazy. And Tesla stock was down like 2% today. And it's like, that's how Tesla's rewarded after these unbelievable earnings. But Tesla was up 1,000% plus in the past 2 years. So it has a lot of that already kind of baked in. Everybody already expecting these ridiculous numbers. So
do you think Tesla will ever go back down to the $500 range?
I think that's definitely possible. You know, 400, 500, that's always possible. That's not a stretch of the imagination at all. I mean, shoot, if the NASDAQ just went down 5, 10%, you know, Tesla could be back there. So, but yeah, when you get these stocks just continuing to climb and climb and climb, they've already baked in so much good news that sometimes it doesn't even matter what earnings they report. And it frustrates a lot of people. It really does, but it's the way it goes. However, on the flip side, you look at a lot of the small caps that have been going down and down and down. If some of those companies just report decent earnings, they don't have to even have to knock the ball out of the ballpark. A lot of those stocks, I bet you, will skyrocket because the expectations are so low and the stock prices are so beaten down. Versus big tech, the expectations are up here and the stock prices are up here. So, you know, unless you report like through the roof, like, you know, you're going down or you're stagnant.
So what you're saying is when it comes to tech, because the expectation for them is just to be perfect. And if they're not anything but perfect, it's like just the stock just goes down. It just drops.
Yeah, because the valuations have just climbed so dang much. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Eventually you just kind of get tapped out and it's like that for a bit. Right. And then the scary thing is when you think about it like this, like you look at Apple, for instance, right? It was a perfect earnings, 10 out of 10. Like it doesn't get better than that. And that stock still was down, I think, 2% after hours. Imagine if Apple had just reported decent earnings, or dare I even say, imagine if they had reported bad earnings. Imagine where that stock would have been after hours, right? So, you know,
like the stock market doesn't make sense. It would just be up. They're like, we reported losses. People are like, cool, buy the dip. I could totally see that mentality. They just reported a loss. Yeah. People are like, well, people are going to sell it. I'm going to buy it. It's
yeah.
The market does exactly the opposite of what you would logically think. It's just always like that. Just do the opposite of what you think is smart.
Yeah, and sometimes the market's pricing in things to the future too. You know, it's looking out 6 months, 12 months into the future. Anyways, are you any of you guys interested in buying any of the big techs on these earnings? Is that something that interests you or not really?
Yes, for me, I really want to get more Tesla. I got in, I think, in the 550 range, which is pretty dang good considering how high it's been, and it's been floating around 600 and 700. So, I mean, 500, I don't think is that bad. Also, I'm really disappointed because the chip shortage, my estimate for the Model Y is in November, and it's killing me because I need a car, but it's so bad.
November, huh, Andre? Wow.
Andre, why don't you just cancel the order for the Model Y and then get a used Model X?
Can I even get an X for that price for what I got at? I don't know.
A lot of used X's are still 70 plus.
Yeah, and also I'm not a huge fan of the gullwing doors, to be honest with you. Like they're cool, but I think they're a little problematic. Like they can become a little problematic.
Based on what?
Based on the reviews I've seen, people like that is the biggest complaint of the Model X is the gullwing doors, which are both the coolest and the worst feature. I don't know.
Yeah, I have to have them out one day to fix it. Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, they came to my house one day to fix it. And then if you buy used, you might buy out a warranty, which means maybe that would have to come out of your pocket. So when I got it fixed, they came to my house for free, did everything for free. It was done. Boom. But if you buy used and it's out of warranty, you know, who knows? Maybe that would have cost $1,000, $2,000. You know, I have no clue.
I mean, plus, like used cars are legit 99% within the price of a new car. So you might as well just buy a new car. Like the used cars, they are just as expensive as a new car right now.
Yeah.
It's unfortunate.
Yeah. So, wow. All the way to November, though. That's that's really out there. I didn't know it was that bad. Man.
Yeah. Did you? I didn't tune into the earnings call, but based on what I just saw, Elon was just complaining that like, hey, we can't deliver things. And it's like beyond their control. They can't do anything about it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, obviously there's a chip shortage. And then he specifically on the earnings call, he stated that they were having trouble getting some seat belts, which is like the simplest thing. Like, geez, come on, seat belts, seriously? And some simple airbag stuff, believe it or not. So it's not even like the most complicated things like you would think of, like super boring stuff, but you're not going to ship a car without seatbelts or without an airbag. So,
Andre, I found a 2017 Model X P100D, ludicrous full self-driving, $85,000. And the reason I say a Model X is because the entire thing you could do a write-off in the first year.
So, yeah, but I mean, that's 20 grand more than what I'm paying. That's pretty substantially.
That's not, it's really not. Considering that you're getting a P100D with full self-driving.
Yeah. See, okay, maybe I'm crazy. I want to hear people in the comment section. But like when it comes to fast cars for me, and this is something I had to consider when I was ordering the Model Y, I was like, should I get the performance edition? Because I think that's awesome. Like just getting that roller coaster on tap feature is the coolest thing ever about a Tesla. And I was like, but it's a Model Y though. And a Model X is like the same thing. It's like, I'm not going to get a fast car and what's supposed to be a mom car. Like even though it is extremely fast, it is just, it's not as fast as what Tesla is about to offer with the Model S and the Roadster.
Two things, but first resale. So you're going to get a lot, whatever you spend on that, you're going to get it back in resale. So the money you're just temporarily tying up in the car and you do this for the tax write-off. Take the cost of the car, cut it in half.
I mean, I could literally do that with what I'm buying now, though.
No, you can't.
How so?
Not with the Model Y. No, you cannot. It's not heavy enough. You got to look up the Section 179 deduction. The car's got to weigh more than 6,000 pounds. The Model Y does not qualify for that.
What is the amount of tax deduction? Do you know? The
full amount. If you're using it exclusively for business, it's 100% worth here.
I would so not. I work at home. Like unless I told the IRS, like, yeah, this is totally for business.
Well, whatever it is, you might be able to write it off that amount. I've seen someone posted on the Tesla forum. They purposely took delivery of the car like the last week of December, and they wrote the entire cost of the car off that last week of that last calendar month to be able to qualify for that deduction.
Right. No, my fear is just because I work at home, I'm going to have a really hard time explaining to the IRS. Like,
talk to a CPA, but you do enough driving around the city for B-roll that, you know, talk to a CPA.
Okay. I'll ask. That's cool, though. What is it called? The
Section 179 deduction.
Section
179. And it's only for vehicles that weigh more than 6,000 pounds. Okay. So that's why a lot of people got all crazy about the Rolls-Royce Cullinan. I believe the Mercedes G-Wagon also qualifies, the Audi Q7, I think it is. There's a few big cars that will qualify for that deduction.
Right.
One second. I'm reaching for my charger.
That's why everybody's getting those dang big boy Rolls. Hey, I found somebody. We need to kick this person out of the chat. Their name is Chris Servilla. They said, get the Ford Lightning. Chris, that's just evil, man. We're not going to kick you, okay? But come on, this is a Tesla family, man. The Ford Lightning. No, I'll give Ford respect, man. Ford. You know, I think Ford has the most compelling EV in that Mustang EV out of anybody I've seen outside of Tesla. To be honest, I can't. Like, if you told me I got to go buy another EV today and it can't be a Tesla, I would probably get one of those Mustang SUVs. They actually look pretty good. The specs on them are pretty good. Like, it looks solid. So I got to give some Ford some respect. I don't know if either of you guys own Ford stock, but I got to give them some love, man.
No, but actually another car I was really looking at, because I'm very jealous of one of Graham's cars that I just don't want to spend the money on. But I've been looking at a Mazda Miata, the new one with the hardtop convertible. There's like a cult following of that car. It's like the smallest, funnest car you'll ever drive. You'll be going the speed limit, but you'll feel like you're on a track. It's so fun.
It's funny to see kind of like these groups, especially in the car space that. You know, when I got a 350Z back in like, I think 2011. And I definitely experienced that when people would like, you know, I didn't even know, like I was joining this club and everybody's like crazy about it. I'm like, what the heck? Like, this is like a big deal, but people that care, they really care. And like, if you got, I guess, a Mazda Miata, you're like in with that. Like,
it's called the Mazda Miata RF. It's the retractable hardtop. It looks so cool. That car looks so slick.
You spend a little bit more and you get a Lotus Elise or Exige. That one I sent you, by the way, sold, and in a used Elise just sold for $54,000. You would have spent little bit more for an Exige.
You've got the Lotus game, though. And I feel like if I got a Lotus, it should be like, Andre's just going so hard on talking.
There's another one that you could have gotten.
Lotus.
There's another one you could have gotten. It's called an Ariel Atom.
I know the Ariel Atom. I looked at that car like 7 years ago. I like love that thing. It's like a go-kart.
Yeah. Or the other one is a Noble M400. I've wanted one of those. I almost got that instead of the Exige. Noble M400. I don't know, only maybe a few hundred of those cars. You almost never find them for sale anymore.
Lotuses are cool, but they break down. Is that true?
No.
Plug in my charger.
No, I've never. I don't know any Lotus that's broken down, because they're made with Toyota parts. It's like saying like Toyotas break down a lot. They don't. All the entire engine is basically a Toyota Celica GTS.
Right.
Actually, the Evora is the Toyota Camry. It's that engine. You're basically driving a Toyota Camry with a slightly tuned engine.
Yeah, no, I would totally get a Lotus if you didn't already like gramify it.
So Graham, back to what I don't know how we went left there, but Graham, are you buying any big tech stocks if any of them dip?
Oh, big tech, no. Google is the only company that for me, I'm just like, I love Google.
They tore it up, Graham. Their earnings were ridiculous.
I know.
They did like
We could kind of see it. Now, I know like YouTube makes up, I don't know what YouTube makes up for overall Google, but you could see that ad rates have basically mirrored what the Google stock price has done, which I find is pretty unique. And we just see just like over the past few years that ad rates are going up on YouTube. So I've just kind of thought, well, if YouTube ad rates are going up, then probably Google's making a decent amount of money too, and that's across their entire platform. But now I've seen ad rates start to drop. It was starting basically July 4th, ad rates dropped like 15%, 20%, and they've stayed somewhat down. They're not as high as they were. Now, we were at the end of a quarter, so maybe that plays into it a little bit. But besides Google, not really. I did, Jeremy, buy some Win this morning.
Ooh,
at $100. And I was telling myself, if it drops under 100, I'll buy a little bit more. And it did.
Ooh, yeah, very nice. Yeah, man. What if it goes, what's the price that you would load the boat on Win? What would it have to go 50. Down to?
50.
Jeez, man.
Yeah, I think originally that's what I was buying into back in like April of last year.
Oh, yeah. But that's like in a once in a 100-year event, man. That's, I don't know, if getting down to 50 would be super unrealistic, I think. Like pushing, I mean, if it was to go down to 80, I would be amazed. Or especially
what was it? No, so sorry. I was buying around 70.
Okay, that sounds
yeah,
about
that's what right. I was buying. Yeah, sorry, not 50.
Okay. So would you load the boat if it went down to 70 again, or?
Yeah, because look, it's so busy.
Mm-hmm.
It's always so busy.
Yeah, so. For sure. It is. It really is, man. Profit machine. But interesting. Yeah. And so Google, wow, that's interesting about ad rates there, Graham. So maybe I should go all in on short and Google tomorrow. The stock's going to be up big. Maybe.
Yeah, like my ad rate's plummeted. Let me short it.
That's awesome. What would Jack do in this situation? Would he be looking at the candies, the candles, and
you know what? That would be a funny way to hedge yourself on YouTube, where it's like you short Google. So if you go down and the platform goes down, at least you make money on that end.
Yeah. Oh gosh. So my goodness. Yeah. So Facebook, by the way, Facebook reports tomorrow. And usually if Google reports great numbers, Facebook reports twice as good a number. So Facebook, I would assume, will report some amazing numbers tomorrow as well.
And then it'll immediately go down.
Yes. Immediately down 5% after hours. Oh gosh. What about any other, like, these bigger techs that maybe aren't as popular you guys have ever been interested in? Like, let's say Netflix or Nvidia. Stocks like that, AMD. Have you guys ever been interested in buying any of those straight up?
No, I think I own like one share of AMD. But I've always wondered. Yeah, one. I bought it just for just to try out the Square app, their investing platform. Or sorry, the Cash app, not Square, the Cash app, which looks pretty neat, just super simple. But no, my question is it better to own the individual stock, would you say, or rather than trying to time each one, whether it's Facebook or Google or Amazon, just maybe buy some QQQ shares or something, or some ETF or something, like a tech one? What would you rather do?
Well, I mean, I'm super biased because I'm an individual stock picker. I've been doing it for over 10 years. So I'm going to always say, you know, pick an individual stock. But also, I'm willing to put in the research time, right? Graham, on the other hand, you know, he said he doesn't want to listen to conference calls. He doesn't want to read annual reports. So for him, it makes sense just to buy the indexes, whether that's QQQ or SPY or whatever, right? So it really comes down to the individual and how much effort or work do you want to put in. I think that's what it ultimately comes down to. But, you know, it's fun to own an actual company that you believe in. You know what I mean? Like, and especially when you make money over time and like that bit pays off. So like Graham's an example. He buys Wind today and maybe it goes down more and he buys more, right? And if all of a sudden Wind's 150, 200, that's like a whole different feeling than if you just buy the SPY, right? I view it as a different feeling. It feels like you one up something even better. Like, oh man, I bought this stock. I made this decision to buy this one stock and it went up and it doubled or whatever. So do you feel any different, Graham, if you make money in the SPY versus stock, or is it all the same to you?
All the same. Money is money.
Okay.
I could see how if you pick a individual stock and it goes up more that you feel like, wow, I beat the market. I picked a good one. But at this point, I think I have like 50 or 60 different stocks. And for me, it's, I don't care. Some days I just prefer the S&P. Other days I'll just throw individual stocks, but it doesn't matter to me. Yeah. So I feel like if anything though, I feel safer investing in the S&P. Because I feel like that's not that that's like guaranteed, but I just feel like that's the foundation. Like everything else is kind of extra, but like that's my core.
Right.
So
That makes sense.
If anybody approaches you and asks you, like, what's the best way to get into investing? It's really funny because when you start, you have this perception of investing as really complicated. And you have to study like chart patterns and see all this crazy stuff. But then as you learn, you realize, wait, literally the best strategy is just to buy a broad market index fund, set it and forget it, just keep buying regardless of the price, just continually, consistently dollar cost average. So I think for us, picking individual stocks is okay because our core is so different. I mean, Jeremy excluded. He's an individual stock picker, and that's how he's made most of his money. But if you're somebody who already has a huge portfolio of index funds, then I would say, you know, it's fine. Go pick individual stocks. But I think for 99% of people, especially if people watching us, I imagine they're not going to have the time to get on conference calls and just look at, you know, earnings reports. It's just not something they're into. So.
Yeah, you have to really be passionate about it, I would say. You know, if you're not passionate about it, it's hard to really like make that time. Because I feel like truly everybody could make the time to be an individual stock picker. I truly believe that. I don't care how busy you are. I still find time for it. And I got a billion things to worry about and a family and all those things, right? But I really love doing it. So I will make that time. You know, somebody else might be like, dude, I just want to watch Netflix for 2 hours and chill. Like, I don't want to freaking listen to a conference call right now. Like, give me a break. Like, in respect. I think it's, you know, and obviously in the crypto landscape, you know, some people want to, you know, put in that work to understand the next big crypto or this opportunity. And other people are like, no, dude, just give me Bitcoin. I'm just going to buy some Bitcoin, call it a day. Like, you know,
Bitcoin is the equivalent of the S&P 500 index in crypto. Like, Ethereum and Bitcoin are the, you know, broad market, VTI and VOO, that's what they are.
Guess what? Speaking of Bitcoin, it's nearly at 40 again.
Yep. Pretty cool. Wow. We're back on the stock to flow model. So we're within bounds again, which is cool.
Wow. Well, Andre, what do you think about people that are still hating on Bitcoin in the respect that they still are such big disbelievers in it that they think it's worthless, they think it's going to zero? Do you think there's any hope for that? Those folks, like, what's your view on that? I would love to hear kind of your perspective.
No, I was just thinking about that the other day. At what point does Bitcoin have to reach in its career as an asset to have at least the acknowledgement from the rest of the world to be like, okay, look, it's a very volatile asset. I'm not into it. But I can see how in the future it'll play a big role in the financial space. Like, at what point does it have to reach that? Because I feel like we're getting that pushback every single way. And I can see how that was more applicable when Bitcoin was worth, I don't know, $1,000, $5,000. But now that it's, I mean, it went to $65,000, it's floating around $30,000, $40,000. Like, how big does it have to get before you're like, okay, I acknowledge it's the birth of a new asset. It's a different way of thinking about it. We don't quite understand how to value its intrinsic value, but it's here and it's here to stay. I don't see that acknowledgement yet from people, which is why it seems like the opportunity to make money with it is still there, which is why it's so volatile, which I promise it will slow down. It'll stop being volatile probably once it reaches in $100,000, $200,000 range. Once we stabilize there, then the gains will be a little bit less exciting, I imagine. But the stock to flow model, I don't know if you guys know what that is or if you looked into that, but that's a really interesting way of looking and predicting where Bitcoin might be headed for the next few years.
Interesting. Can you explain that in less than 60 seconds to us, Andre?
I could try. Yeah, the stock to flow model is basically a prediction model for inflation hedged assets, you know, assets that we can't create more of. So traditionally we've used it with things like gold and platinum and silver. And this one, we had a guy by the name of Plan B apply the stock to flow model to Bitcoin. And in the last 12 years since Bitcoin was created, it's followed the chart like to a T. It's been perfect in its prediction. And the model itself doesn't predict things like that are outliers, like COVID, for example. We can't predict Tether, but we can look at the stock, which is how many Bitcoins there are, and we can compare it against the flow. So for example, the stock of Bitcoin right now is something like 19 million, roughly. And the flow is about 330,000 Bitcoins a year is how many we're creating in the space. So if you divide 19 million by 330,000, the flow, you get, I think it was 58, roughly 58. Now, that number is the amount of years that it would take to mine Bitcoin to recreate the current supply, which is a really long time. Now, for gold, it's like 62. So it would take us like 60-something years to mine all of the gold out from the earth to recreate our current supply. So obviously, the higher that number is, the more rare that commodity or that element is, because it takes us longer to get it all out from the space to recreate what we currently have. So anyway, the thing about Bitcoin stock to flow model is that its flow decreases by half every 4 years because the block reward gets cut in half. So today our block reward is something like 6.25 Bitcoins per block. But in the next 4 years, in the springtime of 2024, we're gonna have a block reward of 3.125, so literally half. So that number that I originally told you, the amount of years, 58, will be 116 years in 2024, which means the flow will be super constrained, which means if demand stays the same or increases, which is what it's probably gonna do as more and more people realize what Bitcoin is, they'll wanna buy some of it, maybe hedge funds get into it, the higher it's gonna go up in value just because there's that much less of it as we go further. I don't know if that made any sense.
Graham, you got that?
No, I watched Andre's video on. I was confused.
Andre, you did your best, man. You're dealing with, you know, we might not have the highest IQs, man.
It's all good. We're not all crypto people.
Yeah. you did a good job. I'm sure this, you know, most of the people understood that. You guys understand that, right? What Andre just explained.
Your premise is this: as we go forward, there's less Bitcoins to buy. That's it. Mm-hmm. There's less Bitcoins to buy and there's more demand. End of story. And as that happens, the price goes up exponentially. And every 4 years, the price essentially doubles and doubles and doubles. That's just kind of simple way of explaining it. Does that make more sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. And, you know, that's kind of the thing that I am certainly not the biggest believer in Bitcoin, right? I'm not like, oh yeah, go, you know, otherwise I would own a ton of Bitcoin. And I don't think any direct Bitcoin, or if I do, it's a very small amount, right? But at the same time, you can't deny if massive amounts of people in the world, which there are, want to hold this asset, you cannot deny it because they are giving it value. And so you can't deny that. And so to see some people still, you know, hating on it and being like, it's going to zero, I'm like, if these people want to hold it, how's it going to go to zero? You know what I mean? Like there's always a certain amount of people that want to continue to hold this asset. If it goes under certain prices, they're going to want to buy it, right? And so I think the whole argument that it's going to zero is just ridiculous. If you want to debate if Bitcoin's at 15,000 next year or 150,000, I think that's a fair debate. We can debate that back and forth. But to say it has no value because I don't believe it has value, it's a bad argument, in my opinion.
I think when people think about Bitcoin, the biggest thing they misunderstand about it is like the overall macro perspective about it. When you think about it in terms of the whole world, it's not just retail investors. So people are like, oh, it's the greater fool theory. You're just trying to sell it to a person who wants to buy it for more. That's dumb. The reality is there's countries, for example, Kazakhstan, I think like today or this week announced that they were going full Bitcoin. I mean, we're going to have countries, especially third world countries, start adding to this to their balance sheet because their currencies suck. Like they're just bad currencies. They can't compete on a global level. And I think because people misunderstand like the global economics, the macroeconomics of things, they don't understand that Bitcoin could be anything other than just something people are like Beanie Babies or something. Mm-hmm. So it's unfortunate. Yeah. I think we're going to miss it. But
in another way to kind of stick up for Bitcoin in this situation is somebody will see, you know, Kazakhstan or El Salvador or whatever, like adopting, let's say, Bitcoin. They'll be like, oh, who cares about that place? It's about where you're starting, right? And if you start, that's just important, right? No different than a company buying and putting some money in their treasury into Bitcoin. It's a start and it's a growth pattern. And you know, it's not, you don't have to all of a sudden have the United States say, oh, Bitcoin's the future for us. Like that's not gonna happen right now, right? But maybe in 5 years and 10 years it does because all these other countries adopt and maybe over time the US has to, like you never know how these things will play out, right? But to just laugh it off and be like, who cares? Like, you know, I definitely watch people do that with Tesla stock over time. Tesla was a niche automaker, right? And it's becoming bigger and bigger. And still people would be like, well, they only sold this amount. And it's like, well, look at where the trajectory is going. Everything's going in their favor, similar to how, you know, a lot of things are going in Bitcoin's favor, where it's like more countries adopting it, more companies buying in. and those sorts of things.
Right. Which isn't, by the way, for me, like, I'm not trying to tell people like buy Bitcoin regardless of the price. I'm not telling people to recklessly buy it because it's going to millions of dollars. Like, I have to acknowledge traditional finance, right? That's not the smartest thing to do. So just dollar cost average, no more than 10% of your annual income. And if you don't do that, you're literally risking more money. Like, it's a bigger risk not owning Bitcoin than owning at least 1% of your investment portfolio. Like, you're just taking a huge risk not owning any.
That's Jeremy, what I thought. 1 to 5%.
Pointing at you, Jeremy.
Yeah.
Honestly, Jeremy, I'm being serious. Take 2% of your portfolio and put it in Bitcoin.
Correct.
2%. Your portfolio probably, you know, it does that in a week, up or minus 2%. You may as well just take 2% and put it in Bitcoin. I'm being serious.
Yeah.
So, I wish I didn't do that earlier.
Yeah, here's the thing. Like, for me, I probably have more than 2% of my net worth related to Bitcoin because I own MSTR, which that one moves exactly how Bitcoin moves. If Bitcoin's up a ton, that's up a ton, right? I own Coinbase stock, extremely tied to Bitcoin. And then I have several hundred thousand dollars in Voyager.
Facebook and Visa are also heavily exposed to it, too.
Yeah. So, but I own three stocks that are directly benefiting from Bitcoin or not. And those would make up over 2% of my net worth. It might even be as much as 4 or 5%. So, I mean, I could buy Bitcoin straight up as well, but it's just like, I'm already a little tied to it.
I think you should do it just for the perspective of seeing how it works and just like kind of understanding like, oh wait, that's kind of how this works. And I don't know, the more you know about it, the less you're like, I don't get how this stuff works. You can mystify it.
You brought out a good point there, Andre, and I think we could apply that to all of investing about, like, you know, the risk of not investing, right? And I think that's a point that's never stated enough, right? People think, well, the safest way is let's just put the money in a savings account because it's guaranteed. But there's a risk to that. There's a true risk to that. Everything's getting more expensive all the time. The houses get more expensive. The stocks get more expensive. Everything gets more expensive. And so if you're just going to put all your money in a savings account, let's say, that's actually a big risk that people don't think of. They just think in terms of, can I lose it? Does it go to zero? And all along, it's like, well, you know, you're not going to make any money on that in a savings account and then try to buy a house in 20 years and see where your money gets you. So,
yeah.
You know,
which reminds me, we haven't plugged the Clips channel.
Oh, no. Yeah, you're right. We forgot that. Guys, the link is down below in the description. Go and subscribe to the Clips channel. Seriously, you're not going to regret doing that. It takes you just a split second. Go ahead, do that. We post 2 videos a day there. So you see the best little clips, and they're all edited together so nicely. So if you guys want that, link down below in the description where you could also get a whole bunch of other goodies. Jeremy, you want to tell us about that?
Yes, we have a Webull link down there, which will allow you to get 2 free stocks valued up to $2,300. All you got to do is set up an account, deposit $100, and who knows, maybe you'll get Kevin's favorite stock, which is Tattooed Chef. Okay, man, I'm just so sad I didn't get to debate with Kevin. Kevin, if you're watching this, man, I miss you. I mean, it's just not a complete Millennial Money episode without us debating Tattooed Chef stock at some
Jeremy,
point.
Wait. Kevin just texted us saying that he just bought $100,000 of Tattooed Chef.
Quit playing with me. Let me check my text message.
No, I'm kidding.
Oh,
you got me
so excited, man.
That was mean. I'm sorry.
Oh, gosh. Well, anyways, yeah, we miss Kevin. I hope he'll be back next week. So what's this say? Tattoo Chef to the moon. Oh, Kevin, I think she said something, Tattoo Chef to the moon or something. So. Did you guys see that pop up? There was something that popped up on the screen. And I think
we doing Q&A or are we wrapping up?
We should get wrapping up. I got to get going.
All right.
Yeah, now we
got to wrap up.
I'll do it. I got it. So with that said, you guys, thank you so much for watching. Make sure to subscribe. Do that really quick before you leave it. If you're watching this right now, if everyone could just hit the subscribe button. We only go live once a week, so you may as well. It'll help us out a ton. Make sure to hit the like button as well. Feel free to comment if you're watching this back for the YouTube algorithm. And with that said, until next time.
Peace. We're going to be live for like the next 10 minutes. Watch.
Yeah, I know.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HOURENERGY.com. expires April 30th. One-time use only, not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5hourenergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.